coffee. We are given tea bags, milk, and 2 slices of white bread, made so cheaply that I held a slice back last month just to see what would happen to it. Nothing, as it turns out. It curled up at the corners slightly, but other than that, it was worryingly unaffected. It reminded me of a story we were told at school about how the poor in the 19th century were sold bread which was made with chalk and other inedible substances to pack it out. Prisons, mostly now run by private companies with ridiculous made-up names designed to sound commanding, would probably admire such methods and rue the day food standards were imposed. I don't have much of an appetite in here as it happens. The prison diet could surely be marketed to those vain Instagrammers who shill appetite suppressants and dubious vitamins. Just eat bland dough 3 times a day and trade anything left over for cigarettes. Your standard-issue tracksuit will be suitably loose in no time. Kelly asks if I want to talk anything over, tilting her head in what I imagine she thinks is a sympathetic gesture. She knows my final appeal is due any day now, and her recent forays into group therapy seem to have convinced her that she has a bright future in counselling. I have to stifle the urge to explain that the best therapy that Harley Street has to offer wouldn't help me much, so I doubt that Kelly's offer of trying to contact my inner child will suddenly fix whatever she imagines might be wrong with me. Besides the fact that Kelly is an undeniable moron, I think talking is overrated. As my mum used to say, never complain, never explain. Although she died inconsiderately early and left me to rectify the wrongs done to her, which is why I'm here. A bit more complaining might not have been such a bad thing, on balance. After Kelly takes the hint and wanders off to go coach someone else, I settle down on my bunk and start writing down my story. I've not got long if I want to set it all out in full. The result of my appeal will be with me shortly, according to the long-faced solicitor I've engaged, who wears the most beautifully tailored suits when he visits, but spoils the entire look by pairing them with garish loafers. I imagine he thinks these add a touch of character, but they tell me that actually he has none. Perhaps a younger second wife bought them in the hope of making him seem more youthful. I wish she hadn't. Absurd vanity is not a trait I particularly wish to see in a lawyer attempting to get me out of a life sentence, especially not if my hefty fees encourage him to buy more of the terrible things. I was born 28 years ago at the Whittington Hospital, the only daughter of Marie Bernard, a young French woman who had been living in London for 3 years before falling pregnant with me. After giving birth alone, she took me back to her studio flat in Holloway, where I experienced the boredom and claustrophobia of a confined space and all the limited joys of a toilet in the bedroom. Studio is such a misleading description when applied to property, conjuring images of an airy and large room where one is bound to be creative and perhaps hold chic gatherings where beautiful people hang over balconies to smoke. Our flat was on the 5th floor of a building which housed a chicken shop at ground level. The landlord, perhaps as part of a complicated social experiment to see how many people he could house in one old Victorian building meant for 4, had divided up each floor to make 3 flats each. My mother and I lived in one room, with a small attic window which did not open, either because of an impressive accumulation of pigeon shit or because said landlord didn't want us to be tempted to yell at passers-by to save us. We never did find out which. This sounds quaintly Dickensian, doesn't it? It was not. Don't forget the chicken shop. My mum slept on the pull-out sofa and I had the single bed. I still get stabs of guilt when I think of how hard she worked and how tired she was, and yet still always insisted that she liked the lumpy couch. As a selfish child, I didn't think to offer her the bed. As a grown-up, I splashed out on a king-size memory foam job from John Lewis, but never stopped falling asleep thinking about her on that sofa. It rather ruined the extravagance, if I'm honest. Marie had come to England because she was told she was pretty enough to be a model, and she was. My mother was strikingly beautiful, with olive skin and shaggy brown hair which she clipped up in a bun no matter how many times I implored her to wear it down. She had that effortless French girl vibe, which every fashion influencer tries to copy now, to varying degrees of success. No bra, ever. Wide slacks and a long gold chain upon which hung a miniature portrait of an old man, his identity lost to time. Before I came along, she'd done a few small campaigns, modelling for high street stores that were long gone by the time I was born. Kukai, she insisted, was the coolest shop of its day, and she kept a rolled-up poster that she'd featured in, which had hung in their shop windows for an autumn campaign. In it, she's crouched on the ground, a brown cardigan draped over her knees, covering a short dress and platform trainers, which I've seen making a regrettable return to high streets recently. My mother was too short for catwalk modelling, and her career never took off in the way she'd dreamt about when she came to London and shared a flat with two other European girls seeking success. But she certainly had fun for a while. The London nightlife in the early 90s was, to hear Marie tell it, a golden age. Evenings at Tramp, a private members club which opened in 1969, were almost as glamorous as when Liza Minnelli used to frequent it. At night, when I couldn't sleep, she'd lie next to me on my small bed and tell me about the champagne served with sparklers in it, and the leather banquets in the restaurant, where she would dine with actors and sports stars and dance until dawn. You could smoke inside, she used to tell me, and the richest women wore fur unapologetically. Her life before me appeared to be one long whirl of parties and castings. A woman blessed with such innate beauty doesn't have to try particularly hard, it's always seemed to me, and Marie never worried too much about money or the future. Someone would always look after the French girl who never wore a bra and wanted to have fun. Someone will always zoom in on the girl who doesn't know her worth. Besides, my mother had already met the man that she would give her whole heart to, the man who would become my father, the man who would promise her the world and shower her with gifts, the man who I would grow up swearing to ruin. Chapter 3. Even now, just thinking about that man makes me tense up. I force myself to breathe deeply. I am a master of self-control. It hasn't come naturally. As a child, I used to throw tremendous tantrums and dive on the floor if something displeased me, as my mother gazed on in amusement and apologised to those around us. That sense of drama lives on inside me, but I've long learnt to keep it in check. If you're going to execute a plan to, well, execute a bunch of people, you cannot let your emotions run wild. It would all get very messy, and there would be nothing worse than to be found out because you were too self-indulgent to maintain self-control. As when I was a child, I have ended up suffering the indignity of having to use a toilet 3 feet from my bed. But at least it wasn't because I gave myself away with a foolish flair for the dramatic. I am breathing normally again within a minute. Did you know that Hillary Clinton practiced nostril breathing when she lost the 2016 election to Donald Trump? She relied on wine as well, of course, but losing to such an ignoramus required more. Nostril breathing requires you to breathe in heavily through one nostril and expel the air deeply through the same cavity. You might scoff, but it helps to calm me down quickly, and it helps to have techniques like this in prison, when you can't rely on quality pharmaceuticals or a decent glass of Merlot at the end of the night. At night, when I cannot sleep and my thoughts invariably turn to my life's work, I often think of Mrs. Clinton, up against that flashy orange moron. Whatever her politics, she stood up to a bully who refused to abide by conventional decency. A person like that can drive you to madness without any notable exertion, while you employ all the strength you have just to hold the line and maintain a sliver of your humanity. Hillary had one advantage over me. Her opponent was a man she could walk away from in defeat. Mine was my father. Okay, perhaps I had the advantage. Clinton couldn't kill Trump, which she must have wanted to. I wish she'd had the opportunity. I find it relaxes one far more than plain old nostril breathing. Marie met my father in 1991. He was gone before I was born. She made sure that I grew up surrounded by love, but by the time I went to primary school, it became clear to me that this love, fulsome as it was only coming from one direction. Other children had daddies, I would tell her, as she fussed over my dinner or washed my hair in lukewarm water over the little sink. In the beginning, my mother would try to distract me, but by the time I was 9, she understood that my willful nature was only growing stronger, and she sat me down one day after school and told me about my father. Most of what I know I learnt from digging around later on, since Marie obviously wanted to give me a Disneyfied version of the man who willingly gave up his seed to create me without a thought about the later consequences. Marie met him at, where else, a nightclub. He had been a little older, she said. Later, I found out that he was 22 years older. How little young women think of themselves. And he had sent champagne to her across the dance floor. Marie had sent the bemused waiter away. She was having too much fun dancing with no need for a bucket of Veuve Clicquot. I have been to clubs like this, and I have seen men like my father night after night as they make themselves comfortable in dark corners, watching young women putting on a show for whomever they think might be watching, waiting to be invited to a table where someone will buy them prohibitively expensive drinks. If my mother had been like all the other girls, there would have been some dancing, a whispered exchange, perhaps even a pleading dinner or two. And that is where it would have fizzled, just another beautiful girl, just another entitled rich man. Except my mother sent back the champagne, and nobody had ever done such a thing to this particular rich man. I conjure up this moment in my mind from time to time. I like to imagine that he couldn't stand to watch her dancing so joyously, throwing off his attempts to impress so easily. I can see him now, reassessing, working his reptilian mind harder than usual to come up with a new plan, a way to command her attention, to bend her to his will. 2 weeks later, she bumped into him outside another club. It was raining and she was huddled in the queue, holding her coat aloft as she jostled with the other hopefuls, trying to gain entry into the exclusive night spot, all desperate to experience the decadence promised within, or at the very least get out of the rain. As we sat there on the sofa bed, my mother looked into the distance and her voice grew soft as she described how a blacked-out sports car pulled up outside the club, splashing the pathetic crowd as it screeched to a stop. By the time she told me about my father, he had already treated her with a cruelty that makes my stomach burn. And yet she spoke about him with affection in her voice, and perhaps even awe. He got out of that car and threw his key to the valet who was standing by. I only noticed him because of the awful noise from the car. And when I saw him throw the keys, poof, I thought it was a horribly arrogant move to park a car in the middle of the road like that. She looked away, she insisted, as the bouncers unclipped the red velvet ropes to usher him inside, and the crowd pushed forward, angry that they were still stuck in the cold. And then a hand beckoned her towards the rope. A stern-looking woman with a clipboard nodded rapidly as if to say, "Yes, you," and Marie weaved through the throng and presented herself to the doorman. She was directed inside, she explained, and wasn't about to question it, even as the people behind her grumbled and booed. As she got to the bottom of the stairs, she was met by him, leaning against the wall, arms crossed, smirking. I've seen that smirk many times in the press. It's almost his signature expression. A powerful combination of arrogance and charm, an infuriating combination too, since you quickly find that with men like that, the arrogance always overcomes the charm, and yet by then it's too late, for the initial mix is intoxicating and hard to forget. "So you don't want my champagne, but you'll accept my hospitality," he said, looking her up and down. Honestly, I still think poorly of her for not turning around and walking away right then and there. Even age 9, when she relayed their initial meeting to me, I remember thinking that this was a truly pathetic opener. If I'd ever imagined that my father might have been some mythical figure who we lost to a heroic act of bravery, this is the moment when that unspoken assumption died. My father was a cheesy charlatan in an expensive suit, and my mother ate it up. I assume she played it cool at first, batting him away with some witheringly French put-down, but even if she did, it still counted for nothing. By the next day, he'd found out her address and turned up in a soft top filled with flowers. Her flatmates woke her up screaming with laughter, as Helene told me much later, teasing her about the British man in the flat cap who was tooting the horn and holding up traffic. A week later, he flew her to Venice on a private jet, taking her to St. Mark's Square for cocktails, honestly, how tacky, and telling her that he loved her. The extravagant displays of affection continued over the next few months as they continued to go out for dinner, to the nightclubs they both loved, to walk in Hyde Park on sunny Monday mornings. Her barriers were demolished. No longer was she cautious and dismissive of London men and their intentions. Marie stopped going to castings as much, preferring to be available if he happened to call, and he did, frequently. But only between Monday to Friday, and he rarely stayed the night with her, crying off with work or explanations about his elderly mother and her need for him to stay sometimes. "Did your eyes just roll back inside your head so hard it made you wince?" Well, yes. We can dwell on my mother's stupid decision to place her faith in a man who wore large buckled belts and enjoyed the music of Dire Straits. Or we can move on. I don't have enough time in this place to unpack the manipulation on his end, nor the naivety on hers. Obviously, my father was already spoken for. Not just spoken for. He was married with a baby, and he lived in a house high on a hill in North London which had several live-in staff, 2 pedigree dogs, a wine cellar, swimming pool, and several acres of grounds. He wasn't just committed, he was embedded. This bit of the story was left out when I was first told about him. I don't blame Marie for glossing over some of the more delicate details. I probably wouldn't have fully understood anyway. Instead, my mother attempted to explain why my father never came to see me, never sent me a birthday present, never turned up at parents' evening. Stroking my arm, Marie told me that he was involved in big and important business deals which affected the lives of thousands of people. And that's why he couldn't see us. He flew around the world, she said. He loved us both very much, and when the time was right, we'd all be together. But right now, we had to let him work hard and prepare for the time where we could live as a family. Did she believe it herself? I've often wondered. Was my smart, kind mother really so, to be blunt, stupid? Maybe. My sex is so often disappointing. I remember once reading about a woman who married a man who convinced her that he was a spy. He persuaded her to sign off her life savings to him to the tune of £130,000, saying that he was undercover and needed it to tide him over until his handlers could safely make contact. She'd never asked for proof. So desperate was she for this ridiculous charade of a love affair to be real. And to compound her humiliation, she'd willingly posed for photos in a weekly magazine and told her story, looking downtrodden and sad. Was I supposed to feel sorry for this person? A grown-up who dreamt of fairy tale romance and didn't question why this man whisked her, a woman in her 50s, who looked every inch of it, off her feet? Marie was a cut above this woman and those like her, but she obviously still had the capacity for similar delusion. For all the ridiculous promises that Marie made to me about my father and our eventual life together, she was wise enough to only tell me selective information about him. Enough to stop my questions, not giving me anything too concrete. But she did make the mistake of pointing out his house to me after a trip to Hampstead Heath a few months later. We got lost in a wooded area and it started to rain. My mother grabbed my hand and marched me up a hill, attempting to find a route to the main road where we might get on a bus. But when we finally got to the bus stop, she briskly carried on as I grumbled and pulled my anorak tightly around me. Despite the torrential skies, we walked another 10 minutes down a long private road until she slowed down and finally stopped. We stood in front of a house and Marie stared up at it silently for a moment until I yanked on her hand impatiently. I say we were looking at a house, but the enormous iron gates with security cameras attached deliberately obscured any sight of the actual property. We lived in an attic room on a main road. I had never imagined that a house could be so important it would have to be hidden from view. Without looking down at me, my mother gestured towards the gates, almost reverentially. "This is your father's house, Grace," she said, still not looking at me. I didn't know what to say. I felt uncomfortable lingering in front of this grand place, drenched to my skin. Marie must have noticed that I was slowly moving backwards, trying to encourage her to head to the safety of the bus stop and home, so she smiled brightly. "Such a shame your father isn't in today, but isn't it lovely, Grace? One day you will have your own bedroom there." I nodded, not knowing what else to do. She took my hand and we turned around and headed away, back down the hill to our home. We never mentioned that trip again, but I thought about that bedroom she'd promised would be mine many times growing up. I imagined it, with pink wallpaper and a big double bed and maybe even a wardrobe full of new clothes. But even when I burrowed down deep into this rabbit hole, I knew that Marie had been lying, and that there would never be a bedroom behind those grand gates for me. And even then, I remember understanding so clearly that something very wrong had been done to Marie and me. So that's my dad. Not the one I'd have picked had I been consulted, but there we are. Some people have fathers who beat them, some people have fathers who wear Crocs. We all have our crosses to bear. I haven't told you much about his personality or his background, have I? That'll come. But if you really want to understand why I did what I did, I have to go back to my childhood again first. Hopefully it won't sound too self-indulgent, but even if it does, well, it's my story. And I'm currently lying on a bunk bed in a cell which smells like a potent mix of sadness and urine, so I'll take any excuse to escape into my memories. Here are some early memories. Marie not having enough money for food, electricity, and on one grim occasion for sanitary products. Getting up at 6 a.m. so that Marie could get to work on time, where I would sit in the back room of the coffee shop and do my homework. Seeing my mother so tired that she looked yellow and hollowed out day after day. Being cold all through winter because we only used the heating at the beginning of the month when Marie got paid. Being cold instills a raw fear in me to this day. I paid to have extra radiators installed in my flat as a grown-up, much to the bemusement of my landlord, and forked out an obscene amount of money for a, in hindsight, fairly hideous fur throw to blanket my bed, because I needed certainty that I wouldn't wake up shivering, as I had done so often as a child. Fur might be unethical, but truly it feels wonderful next to the naked body. Marie dealt with our lack of money and support as best she could. Her parents, disapproving of her life choices, as they put it, gave her nothing. Hortense met us for lunch once, on one of her trips to London, on which I can only assume she terrorised shop girls and made waiters cry for fun. My mother put me in my best outfit, which consisted of an itchy jumper she'd bought for me at M&S one Christmas, which I hated, but she was proud of because it was real wool and had a pie crust collar, and corduroy trousers, which pinched at the stomach and had belonged to another child at my primary school before being handed on to me. My grandmother said hello to me and then promptly turned to my mother and spoke in French for the rest of the meeting. Marie would answer in English, which served only to make Hortense even more determined. As we left the restaurant, Hortense bent down, pulled my jumper sleeve towards her face and sniffed. She said something to my mother as she gestured back at me and my mother's eyes sprung with tears. That was the last time I ever saw the old witch. When Marie died, she sent me a letter, which I didn't open, opting instead to flush it, piece by piece, down the toilet at Helene's house. She must be dead by now, but I hope she isn't. I hope she sees the news reports about me. I hope she and her oppressed old husband got doorstepped by scummy tabloid journalists during my trial, and I pray that their neighbours view them with suspicion, or worse, faux sympathy. So we were poor, and Marie had nobody apart from Helene. B, her only other real friend, had fled back to France after a doomed love affair and a mean model agent who suggested in so many words that she should try to develop an eating disorder if she wanted to make any money. Occasionally, my mother would write long letters late at night as I pretended to be asleep. She'd sit at the kitchen table, tearing up pieces of paper and starting again and again. In the morning, the letters would be propped up on the table, ready to take to the postbox. I didn't recognise the name until I was older, when I saw a discarded attempt in the bin and fished it out. My darling, I know we cannot meet again, and I have always respected your decision. You know how much I loved you, and that I would never do anything to hurt you or jeopardise your family. But Grace is growing up, and I wish so much for you to know her, just a little. I do not ask for money or expect that we can ever experience the closeness we once revelled in, but she needs her father. Sometimes she tilts her head and gives me a little smirk, and she looks just like you, which inflicts such a mixture of pride and pain you could never imagine. Perhaps you could come and meet us one Sunday at the park in Highgate just for an hour? Please write back to me. I never know if you are reading these letters. From this letter, I learnt three very important things. First, that snooping will almost always pay off. Second, that my father was married and wanted nothing to do with me, despite Marie's attempts to spin me a different story. And third, and most importantly, I found out the name of the philanderer who broke my mother's heart and left us to live in misery. I already knew his name, it turned out. Most people do. My father is Simon Artemis, and he is one of the richest men in the world. I should say was, back when he was still alive. That was the bell. I have to go and do laundry. Endless greying sheets to wash and fold. The glamour is sometimes too much to bear. Chapter 4. My younger years were not like something out of one of those terrible books you see in airport bookshops, usually called something like Daddy Don't, which might be a story of unimaginable suffering but only sell because people like to read about other people's misery and feel good about themselves afterwards, simply for feeling the merest shred of sympathy or horror. I read this and cried my eyes out, such a sad story, sad face. is the usual review on some online mum book club. Oh, you read about child abuse and constant trauma and found that upsetting, did you, Kate1982? Kate just sounds like the name of someone who'd frequent a site like that. So glad you could tell us how it affected you. Anyway, my childhood, the part Marie was alive for anyway, had some good moments. I was very loved and I knew it, even though it all came from just one person. Mothers are adept at providing love from all angles, so much so that you often don't realise you're missing out on love from other people until much later in life. Marie took the brunt of the hardship and hid it well from me. Of course I knew she was struggling, children always do, don't they? But children are also astonishingly selfish, and as long as she successfully managed to paper over most of the cracks, I was more than happy to go along with it. My mother would save up her wages from her job as a barista at a coffee shop in the Angel, where hot drinks were at least £3 and cake was made without flour for those women who'd recently discovered gluten intolerance, and from her cleaning gig, which took her to the homes of the ladies up in Highgate who probably didn't eat cake at all. Every 3 months, she would have just enough to take me on a magical mystery tour, which just meant a trip to the Cutty Sark or a tube ride down to Selfridges to see the Christmas lights. Once, she took me to the fair up on Hampstead Heath, where I ate candy floss for the first time and won a fish during a game of hoops. We put the fish in a vase on our kitchen table and called it R.I.P., which I thought was funny, since fairground fish never live very long. Marie thought it was mean and nurtured that fish, cleaning out its home every week and adding some green plants and a desultory rock. I lost interest in that fish, but under her early care, R.I.P. ended up living for 10 years. He outlived my mother. Marie and I struggled on. I went to a nice primary school just off Seven Sisters where I made precisely one friend, a boy named Jimmy, whose family lived in a very large house with an excessive number of rugs and cushions and books stacked from floor to ceiling in every room. His mother was a therapist and his father was a GP, and they easily could have sent their son to a prep school not situated next door to a pawn shop which did a nice side hustle in hard drugs, but they had a big Labour poster in their window and carried a huge amount of liberal guilt about their good fortune, and Jimmy's education was one of the ways they squared it. Jimmy is still in my life. In fact, our relationship has matured somewhat in recent times, I guess you could say. We might have gone on like this, Marie and me. I went to secondary school down the road, with Jimmy initially, who was mercilessly teased for being posh in year seven, and so was sent off to a private day school which had goats and did a lot of art, another tortured compromise made by his parents. And I made a few more friends. Perhaps if we'd had longer, Marie might have got a better job, and who knows, maybe met a nice man to take some of her burdens. I might have made it to university and later earned enough to look after my mother, buy her a flat, get her a car. But if that had been our fate, then I wouldn't be here writing this, waiting for Kelly to burst into our cell and try to lure me into a conversation about her brassy DIY highlights. Instead, Marie got slower, greyer, and slept more, to the point where I was getting up for school and leaving her in bed. She lost a cleaning job because she didn't wake up until 11 a.m. one morning, and some starch-faced witch in a house which had 6 bedrooms and no soul fired her by text at 11:30 a.m. Her back ached, she said one night, chatting to Helene on the sofa as I dozed in bed. Helene urged her to see a doctor, but she dismissed it. "When have I not had aches and pains since we've been in this cold, damp country?" she laughed. Who knows how bad she really felt? Certainly not me. Kids are self-absorbed and parents are supposed to be invincible. That's the deal. But Marie broke it. 2 months later, she took me on holiday for the first time to Cornwall. We stayed in a caravan park on a cliff overlooking the vast sea, and we walked along coastal paths, and I ate a lot of ice cream. Marie drank a lot of wine on the doorstep of our van, and I lay on the grass and asked her questions about her childhood in France, about how I could train to be a photographer when I grew up, about whether I would ever like boys in the way grown-ups did if they were all as immature as the ones in my class. She laughed at that one. She laughed a lot that holiday. I had just turned 13 when it became obvious that her aches weren't just a sign of endless work and constant worry. Helene picked me up from school early one day and took me to the hospital. Marie had collapsed at work, and before I could see her, my mother's only friend sat me down in a visitor's room and told me that my mother had cancer. She'd held off going to the doctor and, like so many women who care for others, she'd neglected her own needs entirely. She didn't want me to know, Helene explained, but I deserved to. I gazed at the strip lighting overhead and felt my ears hum as Helene asked if I could keep calm and be brave in front of my mother. I felt something switch off in my brain at that moment, as though I was suddenly on standby, not able to function at full capacity. I later learned that this is called disassociation, when your brain disconnects to protect you from stress or trauma. It's a horrendous feeling, but it has served me well in times when, well, I've had to do some pretty unpleasant things. Frankly, when you're surrounded by blood and the sound of someone screaming for their life, it's actually a relief to switch off. Marie never came home, and 6 weeks later, my lovely, tired mother was dead. In the brief window between her diagnosis and her death, my mother and Helene had agreed that I should live with her from now on, as if there was anywhere else I could go. My grandparents didn't even come over for the funeral, which was a small affair made up of some former models from my mother's early years in London, a few of her work colleagues, and Jimmy's parents, John and Sophie. We toasted her at the local cafe where we used to go for hot chocolate on Saturday mornings when we needed to escape the damp and cold of our flat. And with that, my childhood was pretty much done. I moved into Helene's flat in Kensal Rise and had my own bedroom for the first time, a small space which used to house her clothes and long-since abandoned old exercise equipment. The fish came with me, its bowl dumped on a dressing table. Helene never envisaged a teenager in her life, but to her credit, she did as well as she could by me. There was always food, and she gave me money for travel and clothes. I never said it out loud in case I was struck down by some vengeful deity, but it was a much better standard of living than the one we had in our depressing bedsit. I moved to a school nearer her flat and became pretty independent almost immediately. Helene worked at a modelling agency and was out a lot, so I would walk around the local park for hours after school to pass the time, or go and sit in the local Costa and nurse a tea, anything rather than go back to the empty flat and think about all that I had lost. Helene had cleaned out my mother's flat, and although there was nothing of much value to give me, she did make sure to pass on Marie's favourite opal ring, which fitted my thumb perfectly, and which I would rub constantly throughout the day. She also gave me a box of letters, documents, and photos from Marie's younger days, including her prized kukai poster. I never opened them. Apart from the ring, I'm not hugely one for sentimental relics. Of course, I was never immune to keeping a few prized tokens after a murder, but that could hardly be called sentimental. But one day, while foraging around under Helene's bed for her hair straighteners, I found another box. This was unlike the one I had in my room, which was decorated with flowers and hearts. This one was like those I was used to seeing in my head teacher's office, sturdy and formal. And it had something written carefully on the spine in red ink. Grace/Simon. Obviously, I was going to look inside. I didn't even hesitate. I still pay no heed to the supposed privacy of others. If you leave something around me, I will look at it, soak it in, commit it to memory. I expect growing up relying on just one person means that I need more information than a normal person when it comes to trust. Or maybe I just want to get inside your head and gain an advantage over you. It doesn't always work. I've been looking through Kelly's diary since I landed in this prison, but it's hard to gain an insight into someone's innermost thoughts when they're so completely devoid of any original ones. I slid myself down Helene's door and wedged myself there just in case she came home. My mother's friend witnessed the whole of my parents' brief relationship, but she'd never given me any information on it, even when Marie died. I know she felt it wouldn't help, that she was protecting me, so I didn't push it. But this box might tell me more than she could anyway. Helene was kind, but she was hardly a great intellect, and had a fairly basic level of insight. Her favourite shows were all on ITV, if that makes it at all clearer. Inside was a bundle of papers in no discernible order. I saw various newspaper clippings, letters and photographs all jumbled up, and began sifting them into corresponding piles. Once done, I started looking at the photos properly. A few were of my mother and her girlfriends on nights out at dark clubs around London. Marie and Helene in mini dresses, both smoking, mid-dance. Girls I didn't know holding bottles of champagne and spraying it around. As I flicked through them, the girls slowly vanished, moving blurrily to the edges of the pictures as Simon stepped onto the stage. There were photos of Simon with other men, all in white shirts and expensively distressed jeans, big gold buckles on their belts. They had their arms round each other's shoulders, just like the boys at school, but chomping on cigars, holding shot glasses, leering at the camera. Then there were photos of just my mum and Simon, him twirling her around, her polka dot skirt blurring but her expression perfectly clear. She was rapt, twisting her head round to maintain a direct look at my father. He wasn't looking at her, though. He was smirking at the camera. He wasn't looking at her in any of the pictures. Instead, he was grinning at his mates, who all seemed to desperately gaze up at him like Marie had, or mugging for the camera, slamming shots, dancing on a table while people jeered, and putting a harassed-looking waiter in a jokey headlock as the crowd around him creased their faces and applauded. It's strange to realise that you loathe your father before you ever have a chance to meet him. Of course, I knew that he had treated my mother badly, but there was more to it. Just from a few photos, he made my skin crawl. His tanned, shiny face spoke to a vanity I'd not encountered before. His obvious need to grab all attention available was pathetic. He took up other people's space. Women were pushed out to the margins, only featured as beautiful props for Simon Artemis. His gang of friends looked about as shifty as you can imagine, certainly the kind who would be wise to keep their heads down in a post-hashtag MeToo era. Everything I saw made me feel slightly ill. This man, with his horrible flashy clothes and his clear need to advertise his testosterone levels with every pose, this man shared and contributed to my DNA, my character, my existence. Again, I wondered whether Marie had successfully hidden some major personality defect from me. How else to explain this man, this choice? How could she have made such a huge mistake? I was 13 when I first saw these photos. I didn't know much about the relationships between men and women, the concept of patriarchy, the idea of emotional manipulation, or even just the facts about basic sexual attraction. I just saw this disgusting man openly displaying all his worst qualities for the camera, as my beloved mother stared at him, and I hated her in that moment too. As I shoved the pictures back in the box, I noticed that my fist was curled into a ball, and that the muscles in my neck were beginning to burn slightly, always the precursor to a headache, but I knew that if I didn't plough on, I might not have the chance again for a while. Who knows what Helene planned to do with the files? Next up were the newspaper clippings, musty and fading. The headlines were a mixture of business and personal news. Simon Artemis buys teen fashion chain Sassy Girl. Artemis criticised for sweatshop conditions. Simon and Janine show off their perfect new daughter. Simon Artemis OBE, rumours of an honour for the CEO of Artemis Holdings. The last one was from a glossy magazine and had photos of Simon and his wife, who I now knew to be Janine, surrounded by fluffy dogs, fluffy carpet, and flanked by an enormous Christmas tree, the height of the room. In his arms he held their daughter, who I noted was called Bryony. She looked to be about 3. I checked the date on the article. The neck muscles were getting hotter. I was 13 months younger than her. My sister was a baby when Simon was in those clubs, wooing my mother, promising her who knows what. The photos showed the same house my mother had walked me past that wet day in Hampstead. It looked, even to my young eyes, fucking hideous. Janine, I assume it was Janine, given that men so often still assume it's the job of a woman to keep the house nice, clearly had an overwhelming passion for grey and silver. Have you ever seen a silver mantelpiece? I'm not talking metal or paint, I mean real silver, imported from Vienna, I learnt many years later when I was very briefly allowed into their house for a staff party. Janine was a gracious hostess, speaking to everyone for a few moments as though she was the queen, and I asked many questions about her, let's say, unique taste on interior design. She probably wouldn't have been so nice had she known my plans for her and her nearest and dearest, but she was so proud of that appalling fireplace, it's actually hard to be sure. The clippings showed me a little of what Simon did. He owned, amongst other things, Sassy Girl, the budget airline Sportus, and about 1,800 properties across the southeast, the state of which had earned him the mildly amusing moniker, the Scum Landlord. He also owned a few hotels and a couple of yachts which could be rented out by the week if you felt a 5-star hotel was a little too downmarket for your holidays. In what was the very definition of a vanity project in 1998, Simon and Janine also had a vineyard and produced wine, which I assume was only bought by their friends and cronies. It was bottled under the name Sheik Chablis, as if anything could tell you more about a person. The last thing in the box was a thick cream envelope. Inside were two pieces of paper. The first one I opened was a letter from Simon himself. It was a hasty scrawl written in black ink, the words almost ripping through the paper. "Marie, thank you for your letter. I am sorry to hear that you are ill, but what you suggest is impossible. As I have told you many times before, your decision to have your child was yours alone. You had no right to imagine that I'd risk my family and reputation for the product of a 6-week fling. Instead, you chose to have the baby, which I have no proof is mine anyway, and then try to entice me into seeing her. This delusion has to stop. Your daughter is not, nor ever will be, a part of my family. I have a wife, Marie. I have a daughter. I may possibly be due a peerage in next year's honours list. You must stop trying to impress upon my life. I have enclosed a cheque for £5,000, which is more than generous, but given your health problems, feels like the right thing to do. In return, I demand that you cease all contact. Simon." The other letter in the envelope was the letter my mother had sent, which provoked this nightmarish screed. I didn't want to read her, please, see the vulnerability and sadness in her own handwriting. It was too embarrassing to see how weak my mother was in the face of this man. She was weak, but I was strong. So I would read it and reinforce the rage in my stomach, fortify it with steel, and keep it there. I opened it. "Dearest Simon, I know you have asked me not to write, and I have tried to respect your decision, though it makes me sad. But I must tell you that I am not well. I will not live too long, according to the good doctors at the Whittington Hospital. It is not far from you. I am resigned to it, not because I wish to die, but because I am tired. I'm tired and I have felt unwell for many years now, and life since I had Grace has been hard, and it does not seem to be getting any easier. But do not for one second think I blame Grace. She has been a light through it all. I wish so much that you had met her as a baby, as a toddler, when she was 6 and insisted on being called Crystal. I wish you had been there for her frog phase, when she ribbited instead of speaking for a week, or when she won the drawing prize at school. You have missed so much, but you do not have to miss the rest. I will. I will miss it all, and it makes me so anxious that I cannot sleep. Though truthfully, the monitor and the ward noise don't help. Simon, you must take her. You must tell your wife about her. She will forgive you for something which happened so many years ago. Surely, as a mother, she would not let a child go without both her parents. I have little money to ensure her coming teenage years will be smooth, and my parents have never stopped being angry with me for my choices. I will not let her blossoming spirit be squashed by them. My friend Helene has offered to take her in, but it would not be as wonderful as having her own family around her. I do not want to beg, but I will, for our daughter's sake. Please do the right thing. I know you are a good man, and that you would not leave your own child alone in the world. I will not be going home, so please write to me at the hospital. Floor 4, the Hummingbird Ward. All my love and affection. Marie." I shut the file, pushed it back under the bed, and checked the floor for any loose paper which might give me away to Helene. After that, I must have walked straight out of the flat because I found myself in the local park, where I sat down on a bench and tried to slow my heart down. I stroked the palm of my hand with my other one and tugged at the bottom of my throat, trying to loosen the lump which had suddenly taken up residence there. I knew more about my father than ever before. I knew he was rich beyond comprehension. I knew he had a family, a home, a horrible mantelpiece. He owned businesses I had heard of. Sassy girl was a label the girls at school wore. He was a public figure. My mother had asked him for help as she was dying and humiliated me by doing so. And he had rejected her, berated her, and knocked her down. I wanted to run to his house and jump on him, hit him, push my fingers into his eyes and force his head against his hideous marble floor. I breathed slowly, trying to focus on the seesaw in the children's play area. But the rage stayed. I knew it wouldn't fade now, no matter how calm I could make myself feel outwardly. In life, my mother had ably shielded me from the rejection, from the callous and cold detachment of this man, and I had been safe with her warmth to surround me. But in dying, she could not absorb this hurt for me anymore. I knew I couldn't really go to his house, ring the bell, and demand that he pay me some vague price for what he'd done. I'd get as far as the bronze gates outside and be turned away. The Artemis family were clearly used to putting up walls and dismissing those who inconvenienced them. Debtors, fans, beggars, and unwanted children. I would have to wait, I realised. Sit it out and come up with a plan for when I was older and more able to make contact. This thought comforted me. I had 5 years until I was 18. 5 years to think up a way to make the Artemis family suffer. I still remember this moment vividly, and I've thought of it many times since, always with a smile. Because even at 13, and though I was too nice back then to let myself think it explicitly, I comforted myself with the knowledge that I would grow up and make them know, really know, the pain that we had suffered. Chapter 5. I didn't much want to kill Andrew Artemis. It had to be done, of course. I knew that and held firm, but I wasn't prepared for one of them to be so, well, nice. The research I'd done on his relatives had been thorough, meticulous, I suppose one could argue obsessive, and from that I'd come to know just how morally rotten this family was. It made it easier to focus on the task at hand, knowing that I wasn't taking anything decent away from the world. In my head, I had even begun to explain away my wholly personal pursuit as a public good. The Artemis family were the embodiment of toxic capitalism, a vacuum of morality, a totem of greed. God, I was insufferably young. The ease with which I offed Jeremy and Kathleen emboldened me. It was luck, really. One dramatic swerve of a wheel and they whooshed off a cliff, not even a scratch left on Amir's car to cause suspicion. So many things could have gone wrong. So many things that make me wince when I look back on it. And if anything had gone differently, I might have lost my nerve, reassessed my plans, or worse, been caught. But I wasn't. I had a full house that night. Frankly, the considerate way my grandparents died so fast meant that I carried on. I can thank them for something at least. Andrew was the son of Simon's brother Lee, and possibly the hardest to glean any reliable information about. He wasn't present at any of the grotesque family parties where waitresses dressed up like peacocks. Thank you, gossip columns, for that tidbit. And neat lines of cocaine laid out on silver platters were offered out by dwarves in top hats. He wasn't on the family yacht come summer, oiled up and lying out on the deck with Bryony and her thin, bronzed friends. He didn't even have a token job at Artemis HQ, the looming building off Great Portland Street where an immaculate grey Bentley idled outside whenever Simon was at the office, the nouveau version of raising the flag whenever the Queen is at home. Even Tina, my Artemis informant, someone I'd begrudgingly befriended when I worked there, I'll get to that, couldn't help me much when I cast around for information about him, vaguely saying that she thought Andrew might have followed his own path. When I texted her to ask why he wasn't mentioned in the magazine coverage of the annual Artemis charity ball. As usual, I couldn't push her too far on these matters. I had to let her lead, so as not to raise any red flags, and my cousin clearly didn't interest her at all. I knew something was really up when Andrew was a no-show at his grandparents' funeral. That was a deliciously strange event to witness from a respectful distance. I persevered. When Facebook failed to locate him, I set up a Google alert on my young cousin and waited patiently. Eventually, I found a mention of him in a local online free sheet, a profile of the work some old crusty was doing on marsh frogs in an area of wetlands in East London. Once I'd boned up on what exactly a wetland was, I realised that Andrew, perhaps more than me, had strayed far and away from the family Artemis, saying something when you consider that my very existence had been denied since birth. Andrew wasn't trying to bulldoze the wetland and build a factory for small children to make flammable polyester clothes, nor was he intent on rounding up the marsh frogs to use their skin for designer handbags like most in his family would have suggested if the profit margins were good enough. No, he was volunteering, helping to observe mating behaviour, ensuring that these hideous creatures had a place to live and thrive, and for next to no money. Honestly, if I'd not driven his grandparents off that dusty Marbella road, I think they'd have done it themselves upon hearing what their grandson was doing with his life. It quickly became clear that the work I'd put in at the Artemis Company would count for nothing if I wanted to try and get close to Andrew. In fact, I suspected it would actively count against me. From the casual inquiries I had made when I worked at Artemis HQ, depressingly few given my decidedly junior role, it seemed that my cousin had cut himself off from the family some years ago, barely speaking to his parents from year to year. Ironic, really, in the Alanis Morissette definition. Who really understands what irony is anyway? That I'd spent so long trying to smuggle my way into the Artemis inner circle and my cousin had broken out just as determinedly. But despite his obvious intentions to lead a different life, he was still one of them. Still likely to be welcomed back with open arms if he got bored of helping disgusting frogs gentrify East London, which, let's face it, seemed likely. And crucially, still a potential beneficiary when the rest of the family died. And as you know, I was helpfully hastening that day along. So I did what I had to do. I researched frogs, bought a hideous windbreaker and signed up to a volunteer scheme at the Walthamstow Marsh Project. I once watched one of those based on a true story movies on Channel 5 late one Sunday night. It was about a high-flying city woman who packed it all in to live the simple life tending to goats up in the hills. She renounced her designer bags and, the obviously male director's eye played heavy here, her vapid life. She saw the purity in earth, in nature, in getting back to the land. It was glossy and the leading lady wore pristine overalls and the sun shone. And for a brief minute I was seduced, before I remembered my pressing family extermination goals. My tenuous point is, the Walthamstow Marsh Project will never be the setting for anything remotely similar. Nobody is coming away from this particular section of nature with an inspirational tale. Nobody will ever learn that the greatest love in life is loving yourself while wearing a hairnet and rubber gloves, so as not to contaminate the sacred frog area. The volunteer induction took place on a sticky May day, and I travelled by train from King's Cross, wearing clear lens glasses, sensible shoes, a parka and a bucket hat. I felt completely invisible, which was disconcerting and interesting at the same time. Nobody glanced at me, no man smiled my way. I even brought a packed lunch with me, something I've always thought was a warning sign in a person over 8 years old. According to Google Maps, the marshes were nowhere near a familiar coffee shop, and I wasn't going to risk food which might have been cross-contaminated by anything remotely both wild and in Zone 4. The visitor centre was a bleak affair. That description is already grandiose. Don't imagine a brightly lit complex with friendly signs or a working loo. It was a hut with a corrugated iron roof and, inside, childish posters displaying scribbled weeds and the occasional abstract bird. Roger, the man who ran the Marsh Project, was there to welcome the two of us who'd turned up. I was slightly shocked that someone else was voluntarily coming to work in a bog without the motivation of murder. But here one was. Lucy, she told Roger and me, was a 30-year-old woman who worked in IT but had always had a yearning to spend more time in nature. She had the look of someone who wasn't exposed to vitamin D on a regular basis, pallid and drawn in the face. I fought to keep my expression neutral, seeing Roger's eyes light up as he nodded enthusiastically in agreement with her every word. "You come to the right place, Lucy," he said. "We might not be a UNESCO World Heritage site, but I always like to say that these marshes are the real eighth wonder of the world." His eyes disappeared into the crinkled skin which surrounded them as he laughed. I imagine he'd told someone that line at least once a day and idly wondered if he had a wife who'd dearly like me to dispose of him too. My cagoule was pitch perfect. Lucy wore a similar one, and Roger seemed to have taken it one step further and was decked out in what I can only describe as a waterproof onesie. A thermos of tea was proffered, as Roger leant against the reception desk and described what our duties would be. Though there were repeated assurances that we'd be entering the exciting world of conservation, our duties seemed really to boil down to just weeding. This was very important, according to Roger, to maintain the delicate ecological balance of the site. From reception, we were taken on a tour of the marshes, which only took us 25 minutes in total. Perhaps marsh singular might have been more appropriate. It was a sorry affair, with little in the way of great beauty. A forlorn heron stood some way off and a host of flies buzzed around the reeds, but aside from that, it wasn't singing with wildlife. It also wasn't exactly heaving with visitors. At one point, Roger muttered something about the local leisure centre and how funding was terribly weighted, his face darkening. Imagine a leisure centre being your nemesis. Lucy seemed genuinely interested in the induction, asking detailed questions about netting and composting. I stayed quiet, nodding along, all the while searching for a man who could be Andrew. From the few photos that showed him at a younger stage, he was a tall, slim guy with sandy hair and unnervingly symmetrical teeth. Moderately handsome, might get a second glance at a bar, standard enough, London-level handsome. But apart from Roger and an old lady who reminded me somewhat of Alan Bennett's old lady in the van, ripping up some unidentifiable plants, there was nobody around. Amusingly, Roger wouldn't let us actually do anything practical on the day, telling us that the job was very sensitive and insisting we spend an hour in the hut going over health and safety requirements instead. This mainly consisted of repeating warnings about the ponds, a few measly-looking puddles, I'd thought, but Roger told us sternly that they were much deeper than we could imagine, their size concealed by reeds. We must be very careful when we worked near them, as one misstep could mean trouble. Even Lucy didn't look very convinced at this. As the induction wrapped up, Roger paused reverently, looking to the sky as if seeking permission before he spoke. "And now, for the moment I'm sure you've been waiting for," he grinned. "The frogs." "There are," Roger said with a smile, "only two native species of frogs in this country. The common frog and the pool frog. They are commonly found in shallow water and gardens, but we have a more exotic customer here. Oh yes, we have the marsh frog." He waited for a murmur of approval, which Lucy duly gave, and continued. "The marsh frog is a special kind of fellow. A chap called Edward Percy Smith brought 12 of them back from Hungary in 1935, and they duly escaped the confines of his garden and multiplied. Clever buggers," he nodded, as though the frogs had some kind of master plan to colonise the British Isles. We were guided down the banks of the main pond and instructed to stay quiet. Roger must have weighed 16 stone at least and yet moved with the skill of a practised cat burglar. "Mustn't frighten them," he mouthed as he surveyed the scene. As we stood there, I wondered whether this was really the best approach to finding Andrew. I envisaged weekends spent with Roger silently waiting on these creatures, mud seeping into my boots, rain chilling my bones, and felt somewhat defeated. But I had no better options. Andrew was the next person on my list, and I don't like to deviate when I have a plan. It unsettles everything. After about 15 minutes of awkward silence, as Roger prowled around on the lookout and Lucy stood stock still, her body almost humming with anticipation, there was movement. The old man flicked a hand at us and bent a finger in command. We tiptoed through the reeds, straining to get a look at the promised animal. From the description, I half imagined we'd see some giant multicoloured thing with glittery skin hopping about with joyous abandon. Instead, we looked down to see a small sludge-green speck, the only embellishment a few light green lines on its back. It was just about the most overrated thing I'd ever seen, and Jimmy's mum, Sophie, once made us watch Life is Beautiful. The frog scuttled, can a frog scuttle? Back into the reeds the moment we approached, and Roger gave us a look of deep disappointment, as though we'd tried to spear it with arrows. "Ah, well, you've not learnt the ways yet. Next week you might see a mating, 'tis the season for it." Resolving never to learn the ways of a basic-looking frog, I trailed Roger and Lucy back to the visitor centre to collect my things. As we departed, I spied a notice board with photos of staff and volunteers pinned up, with notes typed in Comic Sans explaining who was who. Not caring what Roger or Lucy thought, I made a beeline for it. And there he was. It took me a minute, my eyes searching for the clean cut prints I'd seen in photos. But in this photo, he had a ponytail and a large earring made out of a shell. Even Camden Market doesn't sell hippie tat like that anymore. What terrible thing had befallen Andrew for him to make such a life choice? He'd doubled down on his decision, though, with an ear tunnel on the other side and a wooden necklace that suggested a gap year had been taken and decisively wasted. I stared at the photo for longer than was probably acceptable before trying to casually ask Roger about his colleagues. "There's Linda, who you might have seen outside weeding." He lowered his voice. "She's lonely, poor love, caring for her husband with dementia." I wondered whether weeding out a frog's habitat was preferable and came to the conclusion that it probably was, rather that than helping the man you used to fancy go to the toilet. "Then there's Phyllis, Phil we call her. A bit of a battle axe, but very good with school visitors. And then we have young Andrew. Does research on the wildlife and is very knowledgeable about conservation. We're lucky to have him. He did his degree in ecology at Brighton and he's got a grant to go and ID undocumented species in Australia next year. They have 240 known types there already," he said wistfully. "Is he around?" I asked offhandedly. Not today. He's at a seminar on fungus in the general population. I must have looked alarmed because he quickly added, in frogs, that is, and laughed uproariously. Finally, released from the trial day, I gathered up my things, pleading an engagement and saying I had to rush. I was worried that Lucy would want to head back with me and dreaded the idea of 45 minutes on a train going over the day's events with someone who'd set the bar so low for a new hobby. But strangely, she had lingered, and Roger had seemed thrilled about it, offering her another cup of tea and asking what she knew about newts. I hoped that wasn't Roger's idea of a chat-up line and fled. So that was that. Every Saturday, I headed off to serve Roger in his tiny, dull kingdom. Every Saturday, I pulled weeds, cleaned pathways, and tried not to feel insulted that Lucy was working closely with Roger on frog maintenance while I did manual labour. Their heads close together, I'd hear snatched words and occasional laughter as he showed her how to trap and mark the frogs for what I will never know. I've since learned that the marsh frog is in no way special, endangered or prized. There were no amphibians that needed Roger's tender care. These mongrels of the marsh world would have been just fine without the watchful eye of a 50-year-old man wearing what looks suspiciously like hush puppies. The only thing that stopped me from deliberately braining some of these animals and leaving the centre for good was Andrew. On my first proper shift, I spied him immediately, cleaning the pathway down to the ponds, humming along to music. What genre I didn't learn since his enormous headphones blocked it off, but I'm guessing it was something like UB40. I waited for the inevitable introduction, and sure enough, at break time, Roger brought him over to meet us. As we said our hellos and Lucy droned on about how interesting the work was, I drank him in. The long hair, almost down to his shoulders, was badly cared for and straggly. He wore khaki trousers and an ancient grey vest, and his fingernails were encrusted in dirt and grime. He was broad and fit, with muscles clearly made by manual labour and not in a fancy gym. If he cleaned up, I could easily see how my cousin fitted into the Artemis family. His face was kind, but his eyes had the same fleck of grey that my father's had, and when he turned to the side, I saw how he had the same profile as Jeremy. Was there the same arrogance? Hard to tell. I gave him the same vague story I'd told Roger and Lucy. I was Lara, an estate agent in North London, had just broken up with my long-term boyfriend, was looking for a new challenge, and I'd had a fascination with conservation and rewilding since uni. I'd deliberately given myself his mother's name to see if it unnerved him, but he didn't blink. Instead, he nodded eagerly and told me that he'd also come to develop this particular interest at university. Off to a good start, at least. That first day, Andrew was busy repairing a fence which had slipped, while the odd couple, Lucy and Roger, busied themselves with frogs and I cleaned the visitor centre. I must just note that I'd not seen a visitor as yet, but Roger was full of anticipation for a school trip on Monday. Just what our young people need, the great outdoors, none of this leisure centre drudgery. I watched Andrew work, effortlessly rebuilding the fence, engrossed in his work. If he hadn't looked so like his grandfather, I'd have been convinced I'd got the wrong person. This man was carefree, simple, hard-working. I'd wager nobody in the Artemis family had done a day's physical labour since about 1963, unless you count stepping on other people to get what they want as hard work. I had to think of a reason to talk to him, and as asking advice on how to properly clean the minuscule kitchen wasn't really going to cut it, I waited until everybody stopped for lunch and took my sandwiches over to where he sat, eyes closed, soaking up the spring sun. It's so lovely to work outside, I ventured. I'm so tired of working in an office, just chasing profits and cynically duping clients. Okay, it was a bit too on the nose, but it got the right reaction. People so often just want you to hold up a mirror in front of their own opinions. This is especially true of men, and Andrew might have presented himself as a woke eco-warrior, but he wasn't immune. God, that's so true, he said, turning towards me and smiling. This place is my sanctuary. I can't bear the way we, as a society, have been tricked by those with everything into chasing impossible gains, just so that big corporations can make more off their labour. Okay, so this was going to be easier than I thought. After 15 minutes of chat about capitalism and the evils of the empire, I told him a bit about my family, the Latimers. Of course, I didn't use their real names or explain that Sophie and John weren't my real parents, but I hedged that telling him about my liberal family who marched against climate change and voted Labour might get him to open up about his own relatives. I guess your family was the same growing up, I said, as I helped myself to his Waitrose olive pot. His body slightly shifted, and he scratched at his neck with his pinky finger. No, actually, I figured all this stuff out by myself. My parents didn't bestow me with much in the way of ideological direction. Too busy enjoying themselves, making money. Well, spending money, I guess. I had the best private education, lovely nannies, a good home, and for a while I guess I drifted down that road. Interned at a wealth fund at 16, enjoyed all the nice